Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. Thank you for listening. Today, I'm excited about this guest. As you know, many of you may know, I'm a real estate investor, and I always start like talking about real estate and how ways you could earn passive income. So my guest today is Mike Ely. He started investing in real estate by house hacking a duplex way back in 1999. Of course, back then it was called a roommate. He lost everything back in 2002 and 2003 and had to restart back from ground zero. Now, he's a great success story. He owns over 1,200 apartment units and 40-plus houses, all in the Cincinnati area. He also buys hotels all over the country, as he's partnered with a group of investors with a cumulative hotel holdings of over $1.8 billion. Welcome to Your Personal Finance. Mike, how you doing today?
Hey, Dr. Ross, thanks for having me, brother. Thanks for sharing your platform.
Oh, man, I just think the things that you guys are doing, you're doing is just tremendous. You know, one of those, I'm not going to say a best-kept secret, but as far as I know, it's the best-kept secret. But I know you're doing and grooving things out there with your investors and stuff. And I just think that that kind of stuff has to be highlighted and promoted. So I just want to go back and talk a little bit about your background. Give us something about your background, where you went to school, where you grew up. Did you grow up in the Cincinnati area?
Yeah, so I was born in Cincinnati. We call it the Nasty Natty, man, out there in the Midwest. And
okay.
nothing special. I mean, went to the public schools. I went to Aiken, and, you know, Aiken wasn't one of the top-rated higher schools. It was ranked kind of at the bottom. So nothing there. But I did go on to Tuskegee University, finished up in electrical engineering. And but I always wanted to do some entrepreneurship. You know, even in college, I was doing concerts and parties and had big sponsors. And my goal was always to do real estate.
And, so you've always been hustling, though. So that's what it sounds like.
There you go. That was, okay. I even had a paper route back in the day. I was, 9, 10 years old, had the paper route. So
did I. I had a paper route. Yeah, I had a paper route. You know, the thing about paper route, man, you got to get out there 7 days a week. You don't have a day off, you know. Every day, 7 days a week, man. I can't remember. Was I down at 10? I know I was maybe a young teenager, and I just remember getting those – nice tips around the holidays. Did they do that back in Cincinnati?
Oh, man, I love them tips. Well, I was lucky. I got to serve, like, the businesses. So I was on, like, the main strip with all the business. So they would tip well, and then some of the bars would always welcome me in and give me a glass of Coke. And I just thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Now, I didn't have any business clients. I grew up in the projects, and we have apartment buildings, and so I was dealing. I never thought about going to the business side, but and I can't even remember why I gave it up. I probably gave it up because it was 7 days a week. You had to get up early, and then Sunday papers. You had to put those together with Friday,
man,
and Saturday.
Man.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
especially when it was raining or it was wet.
Put
them into plastic. And you had to have that throat. You had to have that throat, man.
Unfortunately, the projects we didn't have to worry about a throw. We had to go up in the elevators and drop them at the, you know, in the front, knock on the door, and keep it moving. Now, you know, you can't do that anymore. You know, nobody has a paper route anymore. But you know what's interesting? This is an aside, though. You know, I've lived in houses. I've had my first house when I was 1983. And you know that I've never had any young kid come by and ask to cut my grass. Isn't that amazing?
Mm.
You know, with a little lawnmower, you know, grass is here in Georgia. I don't know about in Cincinnati, but a grass can normally get a cut for anywhere from 25, 30 to 40 or 50 bucks. I mean, how many times do you have to do that in a day to make $100 if you're a young teenager? That's a lot of money for a young teenager, you know.
Down here they have
water boys. And so I don't know if you heard about that. It's a big thing here in Atlanta where, you know, these young men, young boys are going out there selling water and they can make $200 or $300 a day. But no, they got to be out there six, eight hours in a day. So, but anyway, we digress.
Give me the lawnmower.
Give me the lawnmower. I could get that done in 30 minutes and make 30, 40 bucks. And, you know, in a day, an hour or two, if I have customers, I can make $300 or $400 or $500 in a day. So I don't understand.
That's why we're here today. Exposure, man. They just got to get exposure.
You got to let kids know, you know, they got that hustle. So, you know, interestingly, my dad owned a couple of dry cleaners. And when I was a young boy, I had to go work for him for free. Man in the cash register, right? Cheap labor. There was eight of us in the family, so all of us took our turns as we grew up. Where did your entrepreneurial spirit come from? Because it seems you had that back then. Did you get that from anybody, or this came was innate?
You know, I'm gonna go and say that came from my grandfather's.
Okay.
You know, when I got one of my grandfathers, I never got an opportunity to meet. He passed away in 1967, and I wasn't born until 71. 69, well, somewhere around there. But anyway, you know, my grandpa worked on the railroad, he worked on the railroad, and when they didn't go asking nobody for nothing, they had their own little farm in the back, and quite frankly, we had so many eggs that they would give it to the neighborhood and help feed everybody when they were hurting. And whenever we needed more room on the house, well, my mom and they just built it. They just added on to it. So they was always self-sufficient. And my grandpa would always buy them another house. So he had a couple of houses and, you know, had a little farm in the back. And, you know, so they always fed themselves fresh food. And whenever they need room, they just added on and they bought houses. And he read a lot. And the funny side about it, now, here's another story. My grandpa liked to drink his whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And so they always thought he was a drunk, but they come to find out he just had cataracts. So he kept walking into walls and everything. He couldn't see. He wasn't. So he might have been a drunk, but he was a drunk that couldn't see. But no, he was just a down to earth guy and could read people really well. And then my other grandfather on my dad's side, he too had a dry cleaner, one of the only black dry cleaners in the city, in Bluefield, West Virginia, and he had a dry cleaners. And then from there, he kind of left out of that business and he did insurance when insurance was really big.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the leading sales guys in the state. In fact, he kind of took over the state and he was good. And then he was a pastor also. He had about two or three churches. So he would travel week to week to two or three different churches that he ran all the time. And, what was even more amazing, he was one heck of a sales guy from what I learned. Like, literally, he would be at a funeral, and he'll touch a guy on the side. He said, you see their family? You see how they crying? You see how they had to borrow money to pay for the funeral? Don't let your family be like that.
Mm.
Come see me. And next thing you know, he sold most of his policies at funerals.
That makes a lot of sense because a lot of times, and I was in the financial planning business. That was my little stint when we were sharing offline between when I got out of the radio show and started doing stuff. And, you know, that's an emotional sell. And I never thought about that. You know, I had a friend and now you have folks doing GoFundMes to put people in the dirt, man, which is crazy.
Man,
you know?
Same thing, nothing changed, man. Like, I mean, some of the basic things you talk about, finance plan, one of the basic things you need is a life insurance policy. If you don't do nothing, at least pay for the funeral. Don't leave your family with a bill. You know, and that's what most of us have done over the period that leave. You die leaving your family a bill.
And you know, I've always said, and this sounds real simplistic, and people are going to say, that sounds too easy. If we wanted to make a dent in that wealth gap that they talk about, you know, how big it is between black families and white families, if every black family went out and bought insurance, you know, more than enough just to bury you, okay?
That's right.
And, you know, and teach and then share with your heirs,
you know,
what to do with it, because you're going to die. It's just a matter. And in one generation, we can change that. Now, obviously, it sounds simplistic, but my point is that if we did that, if we went out and bought enough insurance to not only bury us, but also leave something and then say, hey, when I'm gone, this is what you should do with it, you know, or teach them how to do it now. That's what you have to do.
That's right.
And that sounds real simple, but it's real basic. And there are a lot of companies out there, some African-American companies and brothers, that can benefit from that. Just imagine tens of millions of folks going out and say, I'm going to buy life insurance. You know, I'm going to buy $100,000, $200,000, whatever, because I'm going to die at some point. You know, and then you show them, if something happens to me, here's what I want you to do with it. Okay? So anyway, you know, that's just my thinking about
it. It's really that simple. It's really that simple.
So we could moan all we want about the wealth gap, but we as a people have a way to change that. And we just got to decide what to do with it. But, you know, the whole thing goes that, well, I'm not going to leave my money. I'm not benefiting from it now. I said, but if you're really – that's what our mothers and fathers and grandfathers understood. They knew they may not benefit from helping you get an education, helping you, you know, stay on the straight and narrow. But they knew that – when you're gone, that stuff is going to stay with you, you know, and that makes a lot of sense. Now, did you ever pursue a career in electrical engineering or anything with your degree from Tuskegee?
You know, I just say it got me a job.
Okay.
That's it. I worked for an electrical construction company as a project manager. Electrical estimator, but really, my electrical engineering degree got me a thought process.
Okay.
It taught me how to think, you know, understand between the black and white and the gray area. You know, I think I commend my education that much. It just gave me a way of thinking, you know.
A way of thinking.
It's a formula to that. And if you follow these steps and you double check your work mathematically, you could do something here. And whereas the most business people, they do have a formula, but then they have that out of box thinking, right? Because they get into these feasibility studies, and with a lot of data, if you can prove with your data, you're correct. And I never forget when I took a feasibility course, I had a headache for like 2 weeks. I just didn't understand it. Like, what do you mean? No. Because in math, engineering, there's a formula. And if you don't do that formula right, it's going to be wrong. And if you build that bridge incorrectly without the correct weights and measures, it's going to break. Whereas in business, I'm like, no, if you have all this data, you're right. I was like, you know, that just didn't make sense to me.
So, you know, it's interesting because one of my mentor in real estate was an engineer, you know, and so it appears that engineers kind of can follow a process. It seems like they can figure out, okay, I need to do X, Y, Z to get here. And I guess that seems like a good, background to have. I'd say it's the only one, but it seems to me as a trend, and engineers kind of have that, you know, they're like you said, that process thinking about here's the process.
That's
if
right.
I follow the process, here's what's going to happen every time I do it, you know, and I guess that makes a lot
That's
of sense.
Right.
So you went, you was an electrical engineer. So, and in 1999, you did a house hack. You, of course, what they call it, getting a roommate. And you bought your first, which is interesting. They come up with these new terms.
No, it's, so funny, it's so funny, man. When you talk, you know, I mean, most of my people I'm talking to are younger, so house hacking is different. But that's why I said, I was like, we just called it a roommate, man.
Right,
it's so funny
right,
to hear
right.
somebody else do that.
Yeah, I mean, because if you got a duplex, hey, you got one side. He's a roommate because I own the property, so he's just coming in there, you know, hanging with me, you know, and doing those kind of things. So they come up with these new terms, house hacking, and say, hey, no, you just got a roommate.
Oh,
you know?
Man, they got a new term every other week, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these millennials are something else, man. But if it works, if it helps them understand, you know, you know what you're talking about, then I'm all for it, you know, because, you know, they got a great opportunity to do something. So you get a roommate. So in 1999, you get a roommate and you're boogieing along. And then what happens in 2002? So you had your duplex. Did you buy more property after that?
Yeah. So I got the duplex and that was just amazing, man. I got a roommate. My rent was $700 a month. And by the way, I have no idea how to paint. I didn't know any construction. I didn't even know how to estimate for that. And I went and painted, or I got somebody to help me paint. And I was so good that my guys, like, they sent me downstairs. My painting skills were that great. He's like, man, I'll finish the job myself. And so I ended up renting the top floor after I turned it over, got $500 a month, got me a roommate. They paid $200 a month, and my mortgage was $700, so I was living rent-free. So, you know,
wow.
You couldn't tell me nothing. I felt like I was rich. Like, I was like Biggie, like no car payment, no mortgage payment.
Uh-huh.
And so then I started buying – I bought another two family with no money down using these old Carlton sheets and Robert Allen techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bought four families. And, you know, and life just started getting better, man, because, like, I did have a job. I was only making, like, I netted, like, $1,600 a month for my job.
Wow. Okay.
But once I bought these properties, I bought that two family first, so I didn't have no rent payment. So I was like, whoa. You know, I was $500-$600 savings a month for me. Like, literally, after I paid all my bills, I had like $300 left in my name. But to then have an extra $500 in my pocket, oh man, it was amazing. And then I bought those two four families, and then I was making, I think, about $700 netting after that. So that paid my car note and my insurance and a little more. So now I'm pocketing my paycheck. Like, I didn't have no bills. I mean, I'm as far as I'm concerned, I was rich. You couldn't tell me nothing.
Well,
I
mean, back
rich.
Then, well, back then, if you was able to have a scenario where your bills were paid and your salary, you was able to keep and do whatever you want. Yeah, you would feel kind of relaxed. Hey, I got this extra couple of $1,000. What am I going to do with it? You know, I mean, so yeah,
yeah,
you would feel rich from that standpoint. All right. So then what happened?
Well, so I ended up buying two full service car washes, but I didn't have no plan. I didn't have no budget, you know, as you may hear the phrase. People don't plan to fail, but fail to plan.
Mm.
And that was me. You know, I didn't have any reserves. I didn't have any escrows. You know, I was a guy that just, like, let's do it. And I didn't think too much about it. I mean, don't get me wrong. I did a little due diligence, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just did it. And, you know, I was the guy, like, we'll figure it out along the way. But that fell apart. You know, I was robbing Peter to pay Paul, and then I got laid off from my job. But I think I got fired, really. I don't think I really got laid off. It was a mixture. And so, you know,
I'm sure it's funny now, but it wasn't funny back then.
Man, Mark Franklin was funny then, man.
Really? Okay.
Look, my
All
mentality
right.
was screwed up, man. Like, here's an example. I'll never forget. So, my buddy, this is me calling him. This is how warped my brain was. So, they're at the job, and some of the guys were fussing at me. And I was like, man, I don't know why they fussing. I called my buddy. I was like, I don't know why they fussing. He was like, well, what's going on? I said, man, they mad because I'm not at the office. But see, I had a pager and a cell phone. Mm-hmm. So these guys would get in at 7 o'clock. All they have to do is call me, and then I could place their order, you know, because mm-hmm. I was the purchase manager as well. And so they started their day early. And I was like, man, I don't know what they're tripping about. And then, you know, they just mad because I'm not in the office. And so my buddy was like, and I was like, look, I'm only live down the street. And I would come in the office about 8:30. And my buddy was like, hey, man, you remember you do have a job. They do. That's why they pay you to be there. And I was like, oh, yeah. But yeah, no, man, I loved the thing, but I lost everything once I lost the job. I was robbing Peter, Peter to pay Paul. And then 9/11 happened. I mean, so many things happened in that year. I had 9/11 in Cincinnati. We had the race riots.
Mm.
And, like, literally my business shut down. Like,
wow.
And then on top of it, literally it rained. Like, you know, I don't know if you've heard, yeah, I'm sure you heard of April showers, May flowers, and
right.
man, it rained 60 days straight.
Wow.
So I got a full service car wash with no income coming in. And then you had the race riots. Then you had 9/11. And I was like, man, and I wish I could blame it on all of that, but, you know, really, I didn't have a budget, I didn't have a plan, I didn't have reserves, and so I lost it all. And I moved back in with my mom and dad at the age of 30. And they painted my room pink and lavender, man. And I guess they didn't expect me to be back.
An incentive for you not to come back.
There you go.
So you've lost everything. And, you know, and so how did you crawl your way back? How did you get back into the game, you know?
Man, literally, man, I did a lot of praying and meditating, and then but I read books constantly. Like, whatever I can get my hands on, I read about it, whether it's literally from business leaders to people that made billionaires to landscape artists to plants to religion, and it just came out. Everything said the same thing. You know, just believe. And treat others how you want to be treated,
mm-hmm.
and believe with certainty. And then in the missing crucial step that a lot of people do, you know, they believe and they say all these affirmations. I am great. I am wealthy. I'm this, I'm that, you know, I'm beautiful. You know, I can do this, but they never put any action steps, you know, and you
right.
got to put your action steps with it, man. You know, faith with no works is dead, you know. So you can believe
Absolutely.
All your work, but if you don't put no work in, man, that's a wrap.
Exactly. You got to do something, you know. You got to take the first
yeah.
step in something, you know. God gave you a mind, do something with it, you know. God doesn't rain manna from heaven anymore. He blesses you through other people, and I'm sure that you
that's
can
right.
testify to that. You know, you meet people
who have
knowledge or have a tip or have money or whatever, and that's come, and you got to get out there and start talking to people and let people know what you do. You know, I was this past weekend
mm-hmm.
I'm an educator, so we were doing a fall festival. We were giving away turkeys, and so one of the principals, I've never met this guy before, I've heard about him, but I never met him. He's part of the group of schools that I'm a part of. He's at the high school, and so, you know, I can't remember how we got into it. I said, well, I'm a real estate investor. I can't remember how we even got into that. He said, oh, really? He says, yeah. He said, because I asked him how long he'd been here. He said he'd been here, been in Georgia for 4 years, came from New York, bought a brownstone. He lived in Brooklyn, bought a brownstone for $400,000, and now it's worth $1.1 million. And he rented it out, came down here.
Ooh.
And that's why I said, that's how we got it. I said, I'm a real estate investor. Make a long story short, And he says, wow, I want to do that. And I said, well, how do you do that? I said, so let me, understand. You got a house you bought for $400,000. Now it's worth $1.1 million. I said, if you took out a fraction of that equity, you'd own Macon, Georgia, okay? You know what I'm saying? And he said, really? He said, yeah. I said, a couple hundred thousand, and you put, you know, 15% down on $30,000 houses and get $600-$700 a month rent, you do the math, okay?
All day.
And, exactly. I said, you're sitting on a gold mine
right
there.
That's how I kicked it off, man.
Yeah, that's how you do it.
You get your extra $300-$400 a month. Yeah.
Exactly. You don't need one. It's just all about, you know, hey, I get $300-$400 here, $300-$400 there. You own 20 or 30. My mentor, the guy that got me in the business, he owns 45 properties. He's grossing $250,000 a year. Okay.
Yeah.
It has a rescue farm for animals, you know, so that's what he does with his money. So how did you crawl back? You started reading and all this stuff. So what did you do first? I mean, you bought more real estate, more car washes, what?
Yeah, so when I didn't know anything but real estate, so I went and got my real estate license.
Okay.
And what I did was I was like, well, look, I'll do the same thing. I'll just teach other people, and I'll learn the market by doing this for other people. So I went in. I was hands-on. I was the property manager. I was the GC. I was the realtor. And so whenever I did a deal, I'll find a deal, I renovate the deal, I manage the deal, leased it, sold it, and I would take a percentage of everything. But
okay.
the buyer, the investor, still, you know, he was the owner. I just did it for fees.
Okay.
And after I did about four successful deals, I was like, man, I got it. Like, I learned from the mistakes I did previously, which was over-leveraging. Now I was buying deals way undervalued and finding in the kind of the loopholes. So literally I was finding deals for $20,000-$30,000 and reselling for $60,000 or $70,000.
Wow.
And so it wasn't much. Well, that was good for them, but you know, when it was all said and done for me, I'll probably make like $6,000 to $8,000 off of every deal.
Okay.
And, but I learned it. And then I built relationships. And then from there, I met some people that had some money. You know, as a realtor, this guy called me out of the blue, like he was interested in a four family I was selling. And, you know, I just talked to him, and he was like, well, maybe we can work together. And literally, he was like, I got $200,000. I'll lend to you. And that was it. That was the beginning. He lent me $200,000 at 2 points at 10% interest only. And I went on a buying spree. And then when I would buy something, let's say I'll fix it up and then I'll rent it for a while and then I'll use some more of his money and buy something, fix it. And if it was something I could flip, I would flip it. And then the net money I made from that, naturally I paid the investor off. And then with my profits, I would pay off those previous houses I had with them. So then I started having houses free and clear, you know, and that was something I never thought I'd ever have, man. I ended up having like, 15 houses free and clear.
Whoa.
But, I mean, yeah, that was amazing.
So basically this private investor became your bank and he was lending you money at interest only. And then you'd go out and buy properties with his money. And then you kind of split the deal, 50-50, whatever it was, and
See, now when I got his money, that was private money, so I didn't have to split none of that. I gave him
10%. And so that was the way that you got into it, because and obviously I don't know what the market was bearing, but 10% is, I bet, 15 years ago, you couldn't get 10% on your money anywhere, you know, so.
Yeah,
you can't even do that. So you started out with the private money and then, you know, got the houses free and clear, and then you was able to rock and roll. Okay, I get that, you know. So now you own 1,200 apartment units. I mean, is that in one apartment complex or spread around 10, 15 different apartment complexes?
Yeah, so that's, I'm not sure how many complex it is. It's It's probably like at least 8 to 12 complexes,
okay,
maybe. 100 here, 200 there, 50 there, 30 there, you know.
And so why did you decide to get an apartment units? How did that happen? You were doing single family homes and now you jumped up, which is a big leap, you know, going from single family. Now you've got apartment, a lot more to look at, you know, in terms of expenses and things like that. And it's my understanding the cap rate is different, you know, on apartments.
Yeah.
You know, I know I'm used to anywhere from 15 to 20%. Apartments, you're looking at what, 9, 12, 10, somewhere around that range.
Yeah, that was back then. It was, man. Man, cap rates have dropped so much; it's ridiculous, man. I mean, they're
really
5%. You know, California used to be 5%. Now they got like Houston. Heck, Cincinnati's around 6%. California's probably 3 to 4% now.
Wow.
Yeah,
so
numbers are ridiculous.
So why apartment complex? Why not stay with single family homes? What attracted you to apartment complexes?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, it was what I saw. I saw other investors and developers doing these bigger deals, and it was an opportunity. Back in 2009, you know, 2008, 2011, that was when the Great Recession hit.
Right.
And all these multi units started coming on the market. And I wasn't really aware of it. Matter of fact, I didn't even know what a cap rate was at the time. I just knew, I analyzed it with basic math. You know, when I bought a four family, my whole theory was, okay, if I can get 2 to 3 units to pay all the bills, all the maintenance, all the expenses, then I got me a deal.
Okay.
You know, that was it. If I had a two family, if the one unit paid all the bills, I did the deal. And so I was kind of using that theory. Yeah, I kept it simple. But like when you get, and you still could keep it simple with multi-units. I mean, the big thing is, hey, after you do this, do you have all the bills paid, the mortgage, and you could put some reserves aside and still have a profit? And if the answer is yes, you probably got a deal.
Okay.
I mean, that's it. Now, but you get a little more savvy. There's so many different ways to analyze the deal. Like there's the equity multiple. There's what they call the internal rate of return, which analyzes the present and future value, you know, cash on cash return over a period of time, you know, equity multiple. Like there's numerous ways, cap rates, you know, how they look at a deal. But overall, two things. The Great Recession came. And the third one was I met a lot of fortunate. I was on like community council in the city of Cincinnati, and it was one of the up and coming neighborhoods. And so I started meeting the mayor, state reps, senators, tons of developers, and a lot of change was coming to our community. And overall, these guys were doing $5, $15, $20, $100 million deals, right?
Wow.
And I would go visit their sites, and I'm talking to them, you know, and just hanging around them. Nothing major, not like I'm calling them every day and going to the bar. Just from time to time we have a meeting. I see what they're doing. And I'm listening, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, they got the same problems as me.
Mm-hmm.
They was like, yeah, man. My tenant didn't pay the rent this month. My contractor didn't show up. I'm doing construction. They stole the copper. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, dude, you're doing $20 million deals. You shouldn't have these problems. And they're like, no, man, I got the same problems. But after their deal was done, after they incurred all the same issues I had, they were taking home $1 million to $5 million. And I was like, golly, I had the same issue as they did, and I walked away with $5,000 to $15,000. I was like, I might as well do these big deals. And that was it.
So you went from, okay, single family homes where you might get $5, $10, $20, but you do an apartment complex, you're looking at millions of dollars in terms of rent and profit and things like that. So what did your first deal look like? What did your first apartment deal look like? Did you do that on your own? Did you have to bring in some investors, or you know, how did you?
No, so I did that. So I mean, I did a few smaller deals, like in that four family, the 28 unit range.
Okay.
So I had one literally, you know, just hanging around people, man. So I worked with this low-income tax development group, and I was a real estate broker. And they had a property in Over the Rhine in Cincinnati before it became this great neighborhood, mm-hmm. before they re-gentrified it. And he was like, "Hey, Mike, I hear you like to do managing and multi-units." And I was like, "Well, yeah." He's like, "Look, man, I got this property. It's got reserves set aside. I don't have time for it. I'll come back and buy it in 2-3 years. But you can do the deal. What do you want? Don't worry about it. Just handle it, and it's yours." Like, he just threw it to me.
Why did he do that?
Because this guy, it was a nonprofit that owned it. They were struggling. He had that in his development plan, and he didn't want to release any of his, you know, labor or his, you know, whatever it is to help. He's like, "Here you go." They just threw it to me like a lob. And sure enough, I said, "Cool." Now, it was a tough project. Now, even though they gave me a deal, they didn't give it to me, but they gave me a deal. I had to put that work in. And I took this 28-unit building that only had four tenants. In 90 days, I renovated and got the whole thing rented up.
Wow.
And they looked at me like, "Whoa, how'd you do that?" And I was like, "Man, just guerrilla marketing and watching other people." And then they threw me another 100 units to manage. And, you know, that was when I really started getting into bigger units. And then when the Great Recession came, we had the opportunity to buy a 48 unit. Now, some of you may not realize this, but, like, you know, these were selling at $1 million plus at one time. But if you break it down per door, you know, it was like $30,000 a door. I mm-hmm. ended up getting this for like $4,000 a door. Like I was all in for we bought it for $200,000 and then we put another $200,000 in. So we were roughly in for a little over $400,000. And 5 years later, I sold for $1.6 million.
Wow.
And I was like, "You know what? I can do this." And then ever since, and every year we kept buying more and more, but the prices kept going up. Remember, it was at 4 a door, then 13, you know, 11 a door, 12 a door, 13 a door. And every deal we did, we sold and netted over $1 million. And that's when I was like, "Man, ain't no reason to turn back."
Once you start doing those things, so your end was you became a real estate broker and you was able to find out, you know, what people were doing. You know, you're talking to real estate investors all the time, you know, people who are buying real estate and so forth. And something's always going to turn up. I had another brother on the show, and he was to make a long story short, he was property manager. And then one day, you know, he was going out there trying to find deals. And somebody said, "Well, this deal ain't going to work." But he went in and did his work and said, "Hey, you know, this is a good deal." And to make a long story short, the guy said, "Okay, I'll fund that deal for you. Go ahead and do it." And he did it, you know. And so a lot of times just, you know, hanging around folks, sounds like hanging around folks that do real estate, they'll throw you stuff that they can't handle, you know.
That's right.
And it's always about – there's always deals out there. The issue is finding the money to do it. And typically, you always can't go to a bank to get the money that you need sometimes. You know, that's what I'm finding out is that typically, you know, the bank ain't necessarily the best place to go until you get established, you know, and you have money, you can put money
that's
in
right.
deals. But I think you kind of reinforced one of the things that I've always heard is that you've got to make money on the deal going in. In other words, you know, you can't buy at market.
That's right.
You got to buy below market. So you go in, you made your money by, you know, when you purchase a property. You don't purchase it at $100,000, you purchase it at $50,000, you know. And it takes patience and obviously, you know, and knowing people, you know, and learning from stuff. So now do you have a team of private investors or one, or you just kind of just, you know, get a deal, put it together, because now you're going into hotels, right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
So, investors. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So now you're going into hotels. So how did you? You went from apartments. So your story about apartments came. You know, I understand how that goes. You know, you had opportunity. People throw through you something. You say, hey, this works, and you learn it, and then you could duplicate it. So now, going into hotels, which is, you know, that's a business. Okay, so that's like the car washes. You got people, employees, and all that stuff. So how did you go from apartments to now jumping into hotels?
Yeah, so I wish I could tell you that it was some amazing thing that made me go into hotels. But what made me look at hotels were was I would be around a couple of hotelers.
Uh-huh.
And, man, they just had this different expression. They were always just happy and carefree. And I was just like, well, you know, it was like I saw somebody driving a Ferrari, right? You're like, well, what did they do to get that? And I was like, well, what did they do to be so happy like that? And all of them own hotels. And I was like, well, man, I got to see what these hotels are doing because I want to be like that. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, multifamily, single family houses, you could do well, and you'll be happy. You know, I'm not saying money buy you happiness. I mean, money buys you options, but it won't buy
right.
you happiness. But
right.
But they had that look, and then I started looking at them, and I saw the kind of cash flow that these things kick off. Like, you know, just to give you an idea, like we're talking about cap rates. So let's say you had $1 million. NOI, you know, net at before debt, you did a deal, an apartment. So apartments, if you had an NOI of $1 million and it sold at a 6 cap, you would buy that property at $17 million. But
right, okay.
Your cash flow probably is only going to be you're only going to net about your debt, you know, $300,000 to $400,000 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. But with a hotel, you can buy, because it's all about cash flow. I don't care if it's single family, multifamily, business, whatever. With a hotel, you can buy $1 million cash flow at 8 cap. And so now you bought that cash flow at $11 million. And you're making, sometimes depending on the economy, if the economy is great, man, you can be making $600,000 to $700,000 on that.
Wow.
Or if the economy's bad, like COVID, you know, you could be at a negative or just a smaller cash flow. And, you know, the only thing that's wrong with hotels when you go into a recession, which is, you know, there's always a correction. But typically you don't see that many recessions like this. Matter of fact, I never thought we would see another recession, anything equivalent to that, in our lifetime. So just
from 2008, you're talking about from 2008, the recession from 2008.
Yeah. I didn't think we'll ever see anything like this. We're seeing that. We're going to experience that through COVID. Now the only thing is, it's so much money on the sidelines. I don't think we're going to see a lot of things be depressed as they were. There will be some deals out there that are depressed, but not as relevant or just out there like they were before. In the Great Recession, you know, no banks were lending. But now a lot of people have tons of cash to buy. So, you know, I'm seeing deals now that are being discounted, but nowhere near what one would be expecting.
So you're saying that right now that there's a lot of – you're talking about in the hotel market, there's a lot of deals being floated because folks are not traveling and the mortgages
right.
on these properties, they can't afford them. They can't afford to go
right.
6 months, a year with negative cash flow. You know, I mean, it can
that
break even,
correct.
But we're talking – they're losing money. So they're willing to get rid of these properties, you know, at a discount because they ain't making no money on them. So if you buy them at that discount, if they weren't making money on them, how do you? What's your plan to make money?
Well, see, the difference between us. Yeah, so most of the time, unless you refinance and pull most of your cash out, you may, if you unless you didn't do that, you may have did the deal and you probably got 3-4 million cash tied up in the deal. And you're just gonna let it go. Whereas I come in, I'm assuming the debt.
Okay.
So all I gotta do is, hey, bring the debt current and you can take over it and you handle the burn, you know, the deficit for the next 6-7 months. You know, because the market should come back soon as, I mean, the vaccine is coming out. It's actually coming out sooner than we had projected. I didn't project that the vaccine would be out till March or April. And then the economy would begin. Now, I didn't say it was going to be back like it was in 2019, but it would be performing, you know, at an uptick, meaning now they're breaking even so they can survive. But now they're thinking we may have some vaccines out to first responders in December.
Right. That's so you're looking at, in the hotel market, you're looking at somebody that has had very negative cash flow for the last, maybe, let's say, just round it off to a year. But you come in and buy it, let's say, January, February, and that negative cash flow, your negative cash flow only may last for 3 to 6 months when the market turns around. So, unfortunately, they took the brunt of it. And now you're coming on the other side, say, well, okay, I'm willing to have some negative cash flow. I'm going to say that you're gambling, but you're not really gambling because you know what you're doing. I'm assuming you're aligned with investors that understand.
How they say perspectives or futures, it's just we're looking at previous markets, and I know it's going to be negative, but I budget for the worst case. Maybe this goes on for 18 months. Maybe it only goes on for, you know, I mean, it's only because of the vaccine. I mean, yeah, it's only because of this corona. Once they know, people know they can go out and not get sick, they're out. I mean, they're already doing it, and they know they can get sick.
Right.
But
so
people
you
be more.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, people be, you know, it's we're going to have so much pent-up demand. People want to travel. People want to just be out. People. So once we get that vaccine, that's everything. The whole market is going to change. Now, I'm not going to say we're going to be back to our regular numbers, but we'll see an uptick, and then by the summer, occupancy would increase, and then like 2022, occupancy should be back. Then 23, the ADR, which is the average daily rate they charge, that'll be back. But then there should be also the thing called inflation, because there's going to be so much pent-up demand, not just for the whole hospitality industry, but manufacturing, oil, et cetera. Like, you know, even oil production is slowing down because no one's traveling. No one's flying as much. You know, no one's producing, no one's manufacturing as much. And so once we get everything back running back, you know, you're going to have this all this demand and everything's going to be, you know, it's like how when coronavirus just hit and you couldn't get no gloves, you couldn't get no mask.
Mm-hmm.
So people just charging whatever they wanted to charge. And you're going to see the same thing in everything else.
And one of the things that I think is a challenge when we were talking earlier about stock investing, when I said people don't have the time, talent, or temperament to invest in stocks, sometimes the same thing goes with real estate because, you know, when opportunities like this come around, like 2008 was an opportunity for people to buy stuff, you know, because things were at a discount. Now there's another opportunity here where, you know, the market is depressed and people are unloading at discounts, and those with cash and the means can go in and buy property and make money going in. In other words, buying a property that is valued at, you know, X, and you're buying it for Y, lower than what the market would sell it for. So it's seeing opportunities like that. So how long have you guys been doing hotels? Because I'm assuming you've been doing some hotels, so you could, you know, you seem to be very knowledgeable about the market. So you own some hotels, and I see that you're looking to buy 100 hotels. Wow.
That's right. That's right.
So how long have you guys been buying this market? How long you guys have been buying
hotels? So our partnership, our group has done hotels for over 30 years. And
Wow.
I came in about 5 years ago, and we formed a group called the Hospitality Group. And,
okay.
And that group alone has over 30 years experience and over $1 billion worth of assets. And as our group, we just started acquiring more hotels, and we've picked up two in the last year, and two more. We are about four or five more right now. But every month we're looking to acquire more. More and more deals are coming.
And so, so you say the group. So are you just the manager of the properties? You buy them, and or you get the deals and set them up. Or what's your role in these hotel deals?
All of the above. So I raise capital. I find deals. You know, I kind of put it all together. I'm what
okay.
you call the deal maker.
The deal maker. Okay, and then you get a little percentage off the top for doing it on
yeah,
ongoing.
I have owner, I take majority ownership.
Oh wow!
We have
okay.
other equity partners. Yeah.
Okay.
We came to play, man.
Oh well, that's good. That's good. I mean, and the thing about it is that, you know, so what's the so you're looking to buy 100 hotels. You've got 1,200 units. You got 40 houses. You know, what's your end game in all this? You know, I mean, what is it? Or do you ever end? I mean, what is your end game? What is it when you say, okay?
I don't think you ever end, man. You know, I used to, you know, people always say, when's enough enough? Well, when's enough money? And then you would hear people like, it's never ends. And you're like, that's so greedy. But it's not. It's because it's what you do.
Right, right.
It's just what you do.
Yeah, no one ever asked Warren Buffett that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's
when you
what,
gonna
80
stop,
years old.
When you gonna stop? When you gonna quit putting these millions in your pocket? Like, why would I stop?
Well, you know,
so,
and
no,
the thing about I would think that once you learn the process, and you could be a little bit more selective, you know.
Yeah,
Exactly. You could be more selective. A deal comes to you. You don't have to deal it. You run the numbers. You go look at the property. Say, okay, it has to make sense for me to do it. I'm not just going to be doing it. And but you're giving me some insight, because that's one of the challenges that I've been having as a real estate investor. Now that you're in that community, things come to you. And, you know, and I had like a guy out of Florida. He's a financial planner. Check this out. He had a property in Birmingham, Alabama. He had like 28 properties. Make a long story short, he bought them below market, okay, renovated them up, and, you know, he was getting like 15%, 16% cap rate on them, and held them. He had investors because he had, you know, his clients, and then he was trying to sell the portfolio. He had a nice portfolio, $1.3 million. I'm like, whoa, I said, I've got to find some people to do this deal, because it was a great deal. He had property management mm-hmm. already in place. He had everything. And I checked out. I looked at a couple of properties, and then I checked back with him 6 months. He couldn't find anybody to buy the whole deal. So he had to end up selling the properties piecemeal. Yeah, you know. Man, you know, he did it again. And so – yeah, so I've got to find some private investors, you know, to for the money part, because I'm seeing deals all the time because I'm out there talking to people. And but, you know, sometimes the bank, you know, once you put 15%, well, you know, okay, do I want to do 15% on $1.5 million? Okay, that's a lot of money. Okay, but there are private investors out there that will, you know, as you found out, that will help those deals. So that's exciting to hear that. So, yeah. Warren Buffett is going to be doing deals until he's put in the grave. He's like, hey, you know, I manage deals and I do deals when they come up, you know, and, you know, why should you stop, you know? And, of course, you wrote this book. When do you find time to write the book?
Man, that book we kind of wrote pretty quick, man. It took about, well, that's kind of a mixed bag. So I started blogging.
Okay.
And when I blogged, I had a series of stories about what I did and projects.
Okay.
And so I took that, formulate that. Now, that took about – I did that for 8 months or a year.
Eight months, I was like, man,
it's time to write this book. And I took all those blogs, and then I spent another 3 or 4 months with one of my partners writing that, and – we put it together, and then I held back releasing it. I waited for the right time to do it, and then we got it out there.
And yeah, it's a great book. You know, I'm looking through it and getting a lot of tips on it, and I'm just trying. You know, my thing, I like single family homes and the sub 50 market, sub 40 market, pretty much. And that's just a whole niche in and of itself. And there's a Facebook group and all that that does that kind of thing. But you've seemed to hit on a great strategy for, and your story is so unique in terms of what you're doing. You know, did you ever think about going to a publisher to get it, or you just decided to self-publish it? I mean, that, you know.
I decided to self-publish. You know, when I first started, you know, I've been kind of around watching. I just saw how other people did it. Again, I was one of the guys like, we'll just do it. And I was listening. Matter of fact, I was listening to Grant Cardone, and he was like, man, I was going to a publisher, and they were talking about a year before they released my book. And I was like, man, forget that. Like, I need to get this out now.
Right,
and
right.
He sold thousands and thousands of copies. And I've met, you know, and as I studied, I saw a lot because of technology. Man, you don't need a publisher, man. You can get your own book. You just put a marketing campaign together. And matter of fact, like even with the music, a lot of people are producing music, media, without publishers, without record companies. And
oh, absolutely.
Like Prince, he did his own record. Now, he sold less. You know, Prince is used to selling millions of dollars of records.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on one of these albums, he only sold 300,000 or 400,000 records. And he made more money selling 300,000 or 400,000 than he did when he sold millions.
Right, right. And you're right, you know, because, you know, your costs are less. You're not having to give up any, you know, the profit. You know, you know what you spent to produce it. And so once you, you know, cover those expenses, everything else is gravy, you know. And that's the way it works, you know. And that's what's happened with the technology. And with Amazon now, you know, you could put it up there or wherever you would, or you get your own website and market it yourself with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these different ways. And it's not very expensive on these platforms to advertise. It really isn't. You know, so it gives you an opportunity.
It takes some work.
And there's a strategy. And like I said, knowing your market. How did you get Jerome Bettis to write the poet? That was interesting.
You know, Jerome's actually a friend of ours, man. And,
okay.
We met Jerome, his good friend, his business partner, Jamal. And Jamal and I went to Tuskegee University together. And never forget, you know, Jerome shows up on campus one day, and he was like, "Hey, Mike." I was like, "Well, hey, Jerome. I didn't even know y'all were buddies." He's like, "He already knew who we were." And Jerome, man, just what you see on TV is what you get in person. He just invited us into the crew, and through him, we got to see America feel wealthy. And Jerome's a very smart guy. He's done real estate. He's done great investments. He's still got plenty of money. And he saw the world. And just having that opportunity, knowing that it was possible on the field and off the field, just inspired me and motivated me and showed me that it was possible for me myself. So, you know, it was just, I just asked him, would he write it for me? It's not a problem. And so it was exciting, man. And that's the big thing, man, just knowing that it's possible and seeing somebody that looks like you and they're doing it. And you know that they didn't come from money or anything like that. They had a God-given talent. Don't get me wrong. He definitely had a fairy tale story. But it was amazing. And just to see him do it, that was great.
That's awesome. So in closing, what advice would you give to someone wanting to get into real estate investing? What would you tell them that they would do with this market? Because this is a unique time in America right now. What's getting ready to happen in the next year or two? What advice would you give them? What advice have you been given giving people?
Man, without a doubt, like, you know, I'm a national, I'm going to say get my book from BrokenMillions.com. But not only that, find out what you like, whether it's apartment buildings, whether it's single family, and use this time to study. There's so many different Facebook groups. Now what I don't want you to do is go and join in every single group, but, you know, Bigger Pockets talks about single families.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great place. And listen to people's stories and people are sharing. And then Instagram, you can go to YouTube. Like, anything you want is on YouTube. I remember growing up, all we had was encyclopedias, man. It was like 27 books I had to go through. And it wasn't updated, right?
Right. Now they do encyclopedias all online now, I think, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Because of the fact information is updated all the time. So share your handles so people, if they want to follow you, and because, like I said, you have an interesting story in terms of people can identify with someone that made it, failed, and then made it back again. That's a rags to riches story. So I think people can identify with that.
Yeah, man.
So you could go
from BrokeToMillions.com. You could purchase our book.
Okay.
And it shares all my real estate apartment investing secrets, the mindset and formulas on how you succeed. You can go to my webpage, NassauInvest.com, NASSAU, invest, INVEST.com. Or you can catch me on Instagram. At Mike Ely Nassau. And you catch me in there. I'm always sharing some information. We always got classes. We got a Facebook group also, Apartment Investing Secrets. So just look for me, man. Just Google me, Mike Ely. I'm around. Hit me up.
Well, I'm glad to know you, man. I'm glad that you're doing so well. It's an inspiration, you know, to hear that you're doing so well and that you're still at it. You're not resting on your laurels. You're looking for the next big thing. And it's exciting that you're doing those kinds of things. Much success to you, man. You know, wish you much success. And hopefully you don't eat too much turkey this coming Thanksgiving. You know. All right, man. All right. Thanks for coming on the show, man. I appreciate you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Talk to you soon.
Okay. All right, man. Take care now. Wow, man. It's always encouraging, you know, to hear from folks. You know, one of the things that I do on a regular basis, I'm always scouting, trying to find folks that have interesting stories, a podcast. And if you're a real estate investor thinking about doing something, then, you know, this is a guy you can learn from. This is definitely someone that hopefully you'll take advantage, follow him on some of his social media, buy his book. I have it. It's about, 100 pages, 200 pages long. But, you know, download it, print it out. I put it in a binder, going through it right now. One thing, you know, he mentioned – you know, he started out with single family homes and then he went into apartments and now he's going hotels. There's so many ways to skin the cat, so to speak, when it comes to real estate investing, you know, and that's good. Now, if you really want to start and learn about real estate investing, you know, Mike Ely is a great source, but also, you know, me and my wife are real estate investors and we're part of a community as well that does this. And if you want to be a part of that, all you have to do is one of two things. You can email me at charlesross@outlook.com, charlesross@outlook.com, real simple, all lowercase. And you can just send a message and say real estate. I'll know what you mean. I'll send you some information and get you going on getting your education. Because one of the things that Mike Ely talked about was getting educated, that when he, you know, before he started investing, he read and decided, hey, this is the way I'm going to make my money. But he got the knowledge. But once you get that knowledge, then you have to do something. You have to step out. You have to say, okay, I've done 6 months of reading, whatever. Now I've got to do something. And my wife and I were at the same point. We did reading, studied, went to seminars, and then finally we had to pull this trigger on it. And we can honestly say, well, we're real estate investors. We're looking at buying about 20 properties over the next 2 or 3 years. So if you don't want to email me, you can text me, real estate, to 404-272-4633. That's 404-272-4633, just real estate. We also have a financial planning business where we help people get their finances straight. And, you know, from credit repair to budgeting to goal setting to wills and trusts, the whole gamut. And if you're interested in that, then the same thing, Charles Ross at Outlook.com, just put in there credit, and I'll know what you want to get information on. Or you can text me via my phone number at 404-272-4633 and just text credit if you're looking to improve your credit. Because one of the things that when starting out, you might have to start out with a bank. You're going to need a decent credit score, over 600, probably over 640 or 650. So, and we can help you with that. So thank you so much for listening. It's been a minute since I've been on, trying to get back. My wife and I bought our first, bought our forever home. And so had to take a little detour for a while, but we're back in the game now, trying to help people become financially independent. Once again, thank you for listening. Enjoy this week of holiday investing, holiday cooking. Don't eat too much turkey. Hopefully don't be around too many people either, you know, because this COVID stuff is very, very much real. Thank you so much for listening, and hope to see you on the other side.